Back to Revelation then, chapter 18. We'll finish the description of the tribulation judgments this hour. Remember, the judgments were the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls. And the bowls, after bowl number 7, is the second coming of Jesus Christ. So we're right at that point. We're at bowl 7, and we've been looking at that in chapter 17 and 18, the detailed explanation of the seventh bowl judgment. These two chapters are an expansion of Revelation 16, verse 19, where it talks about the seventh bowl. So they're parenthetical, as we noted. They do not follow the sequence of Revelation. Chapter 17 deals with the destruction of religious Babylon, the apostate church, and chapter 18 deals with the destruction of the political and commercial aspects of Babylon, the kings and merchants, as they're called in chapter 18. We noted last hour that the timing of chapter 17 and 18 are sequential. Chapter 17 is executed before chapter 18, and we gave several reasons. 18:1 is a good example. It says, "After these things, I saw another angel." Well, what things? The things of chapter 17. So it's sequential in nature. So the best way to look at it probably is that chapter 17, the destruction of the false or apostate religious system, happens about the midpoint of the tribulation. That happens at about the midpoint. And it's executed by the kings of the earth themselves, or God uses the kings of the earth to destroy religious Babylon. And the Antichrist then goes into the temple. This is what Daniel called the abomination of desolation. He goes into the temple and declares himself to be God. So from that point to the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, he demands worship of himself. So there's no place for a false religious system. He demands worship of himself and himself alone. So chapter 17, he took care of the religious aspect of Babylon. And in chapter 18, God will take care of the political commercial aspect of Babylon. And then we will note the reaction. The reaction of mankind is given in 18, verse 9 through 19. Verse 9 says, "And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her," that is Babylon, "will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning." And verse 11 says, "And the merchants of the earth weep and moan over her." So the political system, the economic system, weep over the destruction of commercial Babylon. The reaction of heaven is quite different. In verse 20, it says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." So the reaction of man is to weep and mourn when this commercial Babylon is destroyed. The reaction of heaven is, it's about time. The outline we looked at last hour, the announcement, is in verse 1 through 3. And then there's a warning to believers. First, the angel announces that Babylon is to be destroyed. And then in 4 and 5, believers, you better get out of there. So that's talking more about the literal city of Babylon, I would think. And then in verse 6 through 8, the indictment is read. And in 9 through 19, the lament over Babylon. And in verse 20, the rejoicing over Babylon. So this is the difference between human viewpoint and divine viewpoint. And in verse 21, a description of the destruction of Babylon. And this will end Babylon in all its phases then. Religious Babylon is gone. and commercial, economic, political Babylon will be destroyed, and the city itself will be destroyed. So that's the complete destruction of this system that has been in effect since the book of Genesis, when they tried to build the Tower of Babel. So all through the Bible, Babylon is mentioned as the apostate system. And now, at the end of the tribulation period, it will be destroyed completely. And that will set the stage for the return of Jesus Christ. So let's look at the Lament of Babylon. It's where we left off last hour. And the first thing we'll look at is the world's reaction to the destruction of Babylon. And that'll be the Lament of the Kings in verse 9 and 10. And the merchants in 11 through 17a, and the carriers in verse 17b through 19. And lamentation and sorrow over that destruction will permeate this passage. Look at verse 9. We looked at the earth. We looked at verse 9. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensually with her will weep and lament over her. And verse 15 says, the merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of their fear for her torment, weeping and mourning. And verse 19 says, and they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, woe, woe, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste. And that's the lament of the carriers, the shipping community. So in 9 and 10, we have the lament of the kings. And the kings of the earth will love commercial Babylon. That's why they're lamenting over the destruction of the commercial Babylon. Now remember, they hated religious Babylon. That's why they destroyed her. They went along with Antichrist, and they got rid of religious Babylon. But commercial Babylon, they're going to love, because times are going to be great for them. They're going to get rich off of this. And notice, it's interesting to notice that in verse 9, and the kings of the earth, who committed acts of immorality and lived sensually with her. This is called immorality. That's the man's love of material things above man's love of God. Because they're saying, hey, times are great. You know, I love this Babylon because I can make a profit. And that profit motivation above God's motivation is called immorality. And it's always when people worship anything besides God, it's called immorality. You know, when in the Old Testament, Israel is illustrated as the wife of God. And when Israel worshipped false idols, God says, you're committing adultery. You're a harlot. You're immoral. And the same with the church. The church is the bride of Christ. And if the church worships false gods, then the church is committing immorality. Now the merchants, in verse 11 through 17, the first part, lament. And what's the reason for it? Verse 11 says, and the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. So see the materialism in that? They're not weeping because people are dying and, oh, look, you know, the city of Babylon just got nuked. Isn't that terrible? People dying everywhere. I don't say Babylon's going to get nuked. That's just an illustration. But what would the reaction be? Oh, my gosh, people are dying. Look at the bodies. Look at the mourning and weeping. No, they say, hey, wait a minute. Where am I going to sell my stuff? That used to be my primary customer. What am I going to do now? And that's the merchant's reaction, is that nobody's going to buy their cargoes anymore. nothing about human suffering in here. This is man the materialist, right, to the very end. Now notice, these guys keep their distance from Babylon. Look at verse 10 where it says, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. So they stand back and watch as Babylon is destroyed. In verse 15 it says, the merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance. So you have the kings and the merchants keeping their distance from Babylon and yet mourning over her destruction. Apparently they have deserted the city, kind of like rats deserting a sinking ship. You know, they hear the angels say that Babylon's going to be destroyed and the believers are all leaving. Maybe I better get out of here for a while and see what happens. Now notice their cargoes. In verse 12 through 14, the cargoes of the merchants are listed, or some of them are listed. Verse 12 says, cargoes of gold and silver, and precious stones, pearls and fine linen, purple and silk and scarlet, and every kind of citron wood, and every article of ivory, and every article made from very costly wood, in bronze and iron and marble, and cinnamon and spice, incense and perfume, frankincense and wine and olive oil, fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep, and cargoes of horses and chariots, and slaves of human lives. The fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. Now note, first thing, that these are all luxury items. You know, verse 14 says, the fruit that you long for is gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away. So these aren't necessities. They're luxuries. In our culture here in America, and it's a very wealthy culture, you know, we have very wealthy, even middle class people have disposable income, I think they call it. And we kind of get mixed up over what's a necessity and what's a luxury item. These items that are listed are all luxuries. Jewelry. Gold, silver, precious stones, pearls. Is jewelry a necessity? Designer clothing. It says fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet. J. Vernon McGee has a great comment on this verse. He says, you don't see any cotton dresses or overalls. You know, it's all the designer clothing. Luxury gifts. Every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory. And every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble. Spices and cinnamon, spice, incense, cosmetics, perfume and frankincense. Now, I'm not going to go into whether cosmetics are a necessity or a luxury. Liquor, wine, pastry, the olive oil and the fine flour are pastry type items, not just, you know, to make a loaf of bread, but this is a pastry thing. This is the food of the rich people, not the poor. The poor people ate barley. They didn't eat fine flour and olive oil and wheat. Livestock, including people. It says that horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. So their livestock included even people. Now we kind of don't think of people as livestock anymore, but some of you here, Dave, you've been in corporate America. People kind of are treated as livestock in corporate America. I've been there. I know what it's like. But these are the kind of things that you could buy before in commercial Babylon. Now, commercial Babylon is gone, and the merchants are all in an uproar because they don't have a place to sell their goods anymore. Even the carriers, the Teamsters or the dock workers, the shippers. Verse 17b through 19, where it says, "And every shipmaster, and every passenger and sailor, and as many as make their living by the sea, stood at a distance." And again, they're standing back, watching Babylon be destroyed, "and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like the great city?' And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth. For in one hour she has been laid waste.'" Now notice the common thread through here is that all of these people marvel at how quickly the destruction comes. You know, it has to be a shock. Suppose you had a shipping company and you shipped all the goods from or to Babylon, and in one hour, Babylon's gone. That's got to be a shock. That's got to be a shocker. Verse 10, look back at verse 10. The kings marveled at this too. It says, in the last part of the verse, it says, "Whoa, whoa, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in one hour your judgment has come." And in verse 17a, the merchants say, "For in one hour such great wealth has been laid waste." So everybody marvels at the speed of the destruction of Babylon. Now we hit verse 20 and we have a totally opposite view. You have to completely switch gears when you hit verse 20, because heaven is not weeping. Heaven is not mourning or lamenting the loss of Babylon. Verse 20 says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." So the rejoicing of the saints, first, it is imperative that they rejoice. The word rejoice is a command. It's in the imperative mood. The command is universal to those who love the Lord. It says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets." Everybody, rejoice. It's logical. It says in verse 20, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." So it's logical that they should rejoice. And we kind of tend to play that down, you know, in our society. It used to be, say, World War II, that if America made a big victory, that people rejoiced. We don't do that anymore, do we? We kind of have to hold it down, you know. American forces took Baghdad. Oh, that's good, but boy, those poor folks in Baghdad, you know, had to go through that. And we kind of toned down our rejoicing. I mean, I was jumping up and down when they took Baghdad. All right, put it to them, you know. And that's what they're saying here. You know, Babylon is totally corrupt and immoral, kind of like Baghdad. You know, they're only a few miles away from each other. It's logical for these people to rejoice because the judgment here is retribution. Again, we don't understand retribution. We don't think that people should... We don't believe in justice anymore in our country. We rejoice as believers. I don't know if I like this doctrine, but it's a doctrine, and you know, is that I have to rejoice when God is long-suffering, like He is now. Why do I have to rejoice? Because God is long-suffering for a reason. And all of these terrible things are happening, and God doesn't stop it. Why? Because He's saving people. He's got more people to save. So I should rejoice in this. I should rejoice in God's long-suffering. When the long-suffering ends, we rejoice. in God's appropriate judgments. So we rejoice all the time if we believe and put ourselves under Scripture. You know, the command is to rejoice. God has to judge. And that's, we miss that all the time. God has to judge or He is not God. And we saw that last hour. Let's look at it again in just 16:5. It's only a few pages away. Let's get this in our heads once and for all that God has to judge sin. God is a loving God. Yes, He is. But you know what? He's also a righteous God. And if He didn't judge sin, He wouldn't be a righteous God. 16:5 says, "And I heard the angel of the waters saying, Righteous are you who are and who were, O Holy One." And why is He righteous? Why does the angel call Him righteous? Because you judged these things. So if God didn't judge, He would not be righteous. And in 16:7, we saw again in 16:7 it says, "And I heard the altar saying, Oh yes, O Lord God, the Almighty, true and righteous are your judgments." So God has to judge, or He isn't God, and yet His judgments are logical. They're very logical. Like we said, He turned water to blood. Why did He do that? Well, because the people were bloodthirsty. It's appropriate. It's an appropriate judgment. Now, 21 through 24 then, zoom in on the destruction of Babylon. Chapter 21 says, "Then a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer. And the sound of the harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpeters will not be heard in you any longer. And no craftsman of any craft will be found in you any longer. And the sound of a mill will not be heard in you any longer. And the light of a lamp will not shine in you any longer. And the voice of the bridegroom and the bride will not be heard in you any longer. For your merchants were the great men of the earth, because all the nations were deceived by your sorcery. And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth." So we can say a few things about these judgments. First, it will be swift. The judgment on Babylon will be swift. In one day, in one hour, those are idioms in Greek for swiftness. It's going to be fast. Now, again, we noted the fall of Babylon in history was not swift. It was very slow. It was very drawn out. So the prophecies, and we looked at one of these last hour, the prophecies in Isaiah and Jeremiah are still not fulfilled, because those prophecies say there will be a swift destruction and there will not be inhabitants anymore in Babylon. You know, there aren't inhabitants in Babylon now. So this has to be talking about another destruction. Look at Isaiah 13:1. These are reasons why I think that the city of Babylon will have to be rebuilt, because the destructions that are recorded or prophesied in the Bible have not occurred yet. So if they haven't occurred yet, then Babylon has to be rebuilt so they can occur. And we'll get to that in a minute. You know, there are people working on the reconstruction of Babylon even as we speak. 13:1, the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw. Now look down at verse 5 and 6. It says, "They are coming from a far country, from the farthest horizons, the Lord and His instruments of indignation, to destroy the whole land." Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as the destruction from the Almighty. Then down in 10 and 11 it says, for the stars of the heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. Has that been fulfilled yet? That hasn't been fulfilled yet, and that's what's called Babylon, which Isaiah, the son of Amos, saw. So that has not been fulfilled. Jeremiah 51. Jeremiah 51:8. It says, suddenly Babylon has fallen and been broken. Wail over her. Bring balm for her pain. Perhaps she may be healed. We applied the healing to Babylon, but she was not healed. So, sudden destruction. Remember when we studied Daniel and we studied Nebuchadnezzar's image, and that the next world empire after Babylon was the Medes and the Persians? Look over at Daniel 2. We've looked at this before. In fact, Daniel 2, the image of Nebuchadnezzar is basic to the study of the book of Revelation. But it says that in Daniel 2:31 and 32, it says, you, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you. And its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and arms of silver, its belly, its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So Nebuchadnezzar had a dream, and he saw this in his dream. And it says its appearance was awesome. It was extraordinary splendor. And that's man's view of history, because this is his dream concerned man's history, the time of the Gentiles, so to speak. That's interpreted down in verse 37 when it says, you, O king, are the king of kings to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory. And wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So Babylon was the first world empire, the head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. It says in verse 39, after you there will arise another kingdom inferior to you. So there's going to be another world empire. That's the Medo-Persian Empire, after the Babylonian. Daniel chapter 7 talks about the same laying out of history, the same view of world history, only it talks about it from Daniel's dream, and it talks about it from, or Daniel's vision, and it talks about it from God's perspective. So instead of a beautiful, splendid, spectacular statue, we have wild, vicious animals. It's a little different between man's viewpoint of history and God's viewpoint. In Daniel chapter 7, verse 5, it says, and behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. It was raised up on one side, and so on and so forth. So there's a second beast. The first one was the Babylonian Empire itself. That was the lion with the wings of an eagle. And then in verse 17, it says, these great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. Well, you might be asking yourself, all through this, well, the Babylonian Empire is done. It was superseded by the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire took over Babylon in 539 BC, but the city of Babylon was not destroyed. It gradually diminished over the centuries following the coming of Christ. So there's nothing like we see in Revelation concerning the city of Babylon. So I take that the city of Babylon to be not only the political economic system, but a literal city of Babylon. And, you know, some say it's just a name for a different city, New York or Rome or something. I think there's no reason to take it any other way as being the literal Babylon. So the destruction will be complete. It says back in Revelation 18, it'll be like a big splash a stone makes when you throw it in the water and it disappears. That's the millstone in 21. A strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence." So it'll be a complete destruction. It makes a big splash and then it's gone. It'll be violent. It's thrown down with violence. It will be permanent. And there's another key point. The words "any longer" are repeated five times in these three verses. Verse 21, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence, and will not be found any longer. And the sound of harpists and musicians and flute players and trumpets will not be heard in you any longer. No craftsman will be found in you in any longer." So on and so forth. Five times. It's a permanent destruction of Babylon. Now, that's not the case with the fall of Babylon in history. Now, the city has been inhabited since it fell in ancient times. So it wasn't a permanent destruction. In fact, Iraq was working on rebuilding the city in modern times. Remember, during the Iraq-Iran war, Saddam Hussein started to rebuild the city over the ruins of the ancient Babylon, and it was for moral support. Remember, he used bricks with an image of Nebuchadnezzar on them to rebuild this. So that's happened in modern times. Now, one commentator, and this one just killed me. I laughed my head off when I saw this. I was reading in a commentary because it was written, you know, a few years ago. And he said that this prophecy can't be what we're seeing today because of Babylon. Babylon is a great problem in history. And here is his quote. "In order for Babylon to be rebuilt as a world political power, the Arab nations will have to resolve their minor differences and unite into the world's greatest oil-producing power bloc." What's the problem with all this? Well, before this consolidation could take place, Saddam Hussein must either be removed or change his colors, so he is no longer a threat to the West. I think he has been removed. Rope hastened his demise. So these guys write these things change daily. I'm going to put a disclaimer here, though. I'm not saying that this is that, you know, that this is the rebuilding of Babylon that's going to take place. It could be, I don't know, your guess is as good as mine. But what I want to point out is that things that are problems in man's mind, like Saddam Hussein, who was a nut and wouldn't get along with anybody, you know, he could be gone in an instant. He was. These things change all the time. So this could happen at any time. In verse 24, the last point, it will be a just destruction. Verse 24 says, "And in her was found the blood of prophets and of saints and of all who have been slain on the earth." Now, when we hit chapter 19, we'll get to the second coming of Jesus Christ to bring this period to an end with the destruction of the Antichrist and the false prophet. And then chapter 20 describes the coming of the millennial kingdom. So we've looked at God's wrath, we're about to look at His return, and then we'll look at His reign in the kingdom. Father, thank You again for Your word, which is living and powerful. In Christ's name, amen.